Welcome to the Head Ballet Podcast. This is the place to come to hear my guests discuss with me, Paul Abbott, their favourite novelty songs. The funny, the weird, the daft, and the outright baffling tunes that have been skipping and dancing around in their heads for years. Everybody loves something that could be considered novel, so why not celebrate it? And it is celebration time here at the Head Ballet headquarters, because this episode is coming out to mark the anniversary of the first episode of the show. It's our birthday day, and what better way to celebrate it than with an episode all about the band who gave us the name for the podcast, and, in particular, one of the men in that band that has meant so much to so many people for so long. This is our tribute to Neil Innes and the Bonzo Dog Band, and joining me to bask in their brilliance is my guest, Laura Grimshaw. Laura is a producer for Radio 4 and Radio 4 Extra, and she was the force behind the excellent documentary shows Vivian Stanchel, English as Tuppence, the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, Anarchy Must Be Organised, and, of course, the beautiful tribute to Neil Innes, Dip My Brain in Joy. You can still find Anarchy Must Be Organised on BBC Sounds as of the release of this podcast, so look for the link to that in the show notes. Laura is also a presenter and producer of Podcast Radio Hour on BBC Radio 4 Extra, and I couldn't think of anyone better to share time chatting about Neil and the Bonzos with for this special episode. Remember, we're at Head Ballet Pod on Twitter and Instagram, and you can drop an email to that address at gmail.com if you want to get in touch that way. Thank you to everyone who has shared, reviewed, participated, and just generally got involved with the show in the past year. More reviews, ratings, and shares are still very much appreciated. And, well, I think I'm going to have to leave the introduction there, and I'm going to take you right away straight over to the main bit of the podcast to hear the Head Ballet. I'll repeat that, the Head Ballet. I'll repeat that, the Head Ballet. I'll repeat that. Okay, Laura, so because the record you've chosen, which you'll tell us about what it is in a second, is from 1967, that's one of those monolithic years in pop music history, Sgt. Pepper, etc. But I'm interested, before we get stuck into the specifics of our topic, that, you know, how interested are you, if at all, in 60s music and 60s comedy, 60s culture stuff?
So my thing is comedy. I think the crossover, I mean, I'm going to give away who we're talking about, but basically we're going to be talking about the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band.
Hooray!
And the crossover there of music and comedy is sort of where that culture meets. It's where it's where the Beatles meet the Pythons, literally. So I've sort of found myself accidentally talking about the Bonzos and specifically Neil Innes on music podcasts, and I mean, it would be ridiculous to say I'm not a fan of music, but I'm not a fan of music enough to be able to talk about it.
Right.
But in my head, the Bonzos are comedy and Neil Innes is comedy.
Right.
So they are under my umbrella interest, where my thing is comedy. So, I mean, I was brought up on Python. I wasn't alive in the 60s. My mum was a huge Python fan and a huge fan of Neil Innes when she was a teenager. So she already loved them and had a child and forced it upon the child. And I'm very, very glad she did, because it's obviously influenced my career and everything. So, I'm a really huge Python fan. So that is my thing. So while I may have maybe talking about something from an iconic year, I feel like I'm just talking about the earlier stuff in my love of comedy, which stretches across the decades. And I feel like maybe even Neil would be insulted that I'm saying he's comedy and not music. I don't think he's not musically gifted. Obviously he's musically gifted. He's incredible. But I found them because of my love of comedy.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I came to them, I'm a big comedy fan as well, and the Python particularly, but I sort of came to all of that through the Beatles, because I was such a Beatles fan from a very, very early age. And as you start reading around the Beatles, I kept noticing names popping up again.
Yeah.
And then sort of you got in this idea that George liked comedy and he liked Python. He started watching Python, and you start collecting Python and getting the records. And suddenly it's like, well, who's this non-Python who's in the Pythons here and there? Is this name that's in this book, is in this video, is on this cassette, matching tie and handkerchief, Monty Python cassette, and putting the pieces together and coming to it. And then somebody at some point, I think for me, it was my first girlfriend's dad lent me a copy of one of the Bonzo's compilation albums. And it's like, what? What have you done to me? you've And hearing the intro and the outro, which of more later, you know, I'm just going, this is perfect. This is everything I find about that I love about the Beatles, which is I like the Beatles because of their personality and their humor and all that sort of stuff. As much as I love the music, and it's all the comedy stuff, like you say, and as well. And it was like someone had just gone, oh, here's all that stuff you like. Yeah. I've got it. I've shoved it all together, and I've created the Bonzos.
Yeah, I can sort of see that. I think I obviously came at it from the other side. So I came at it through Python. So I was brought up on Python and knew all of their, you know, watched Flying Circus repeats and all the films and listened to the albums and all of that. But I also was a child at the time Neil Innes was making children's television.
Yes.
So my earliest memories were of watching him on Puddle Lane and him on the Raggy Dolls.
I feel a song coming on. Piano. Twinkling stars in the sky at night. Twinkling stars with their diamond light. On nights like this, the thing I love is to watch the stars twinkling high above.
He was part of my life before I knew who he was.
Yeah.
So he was just sort of always there. And really, the Bonzos was like the last thing of his I found.
That's fair enough. It's understandable, really. You know.
So, you know, there was obviously the kid stuff because I was a kid. And then there was coming to his stuff through Python and then hearing his solo stuff. Because my mum was always a Python fan and really liked Neil. She watched Do Not Adjust Your Set when it was on.
Right.
So saw the Bonzos on that, but it was Neil she loved. And so she sort of followed him and thought the Bonzos were a little bit scary and weird. So, they are, but she liked the very nice chap on the piano. She liked him. So, and then, you know, when he was in Python things as well, she knew him through that and then was obviously delighted to have a child and be like, well, you can watch all of his children's television. So I sort of come at it the wrong way, really. Well, I certainly come at it the wrong way for music podcasts and music chats, because I'm not a music expert. Obviously I like the Beatles, obviously I like music, but it's like I don't have the fan knowledge, whereas I have the fan knowledge of comedy, and the Bonzos are under my umbrella of comedy rather than music.
Fair enough, then. I suppose, then, we should announce the official single you've chosen for this episode.
Yes. Well, I suppose, you know, I don't know how well everybody know. I mean, they are listening to a podcast called Music for the Head Ballet. I don't know if people know where that comes from. but we are going to be talking about the equestrian statue, which was the A-side.
There once was a very famous man. On his famous horse he'd ride through the land. The people used to see him everywhere. When he died they put a statue in the square.
Hooray!
Here comes the equestrian statue.
And the B-side, the intro and the outro.
Hi there, nice to be with you. Happy you could stick around. Like to introduce Legs Larry Smith, drums. And Sam Spoons, rhythm pole. And Vern Dudley Bohay Noel, bass guitar. And Neil Innes, piano. Come in, Rodney Slater, alto saxophone. With Roger Ruskin Spear on tenor sax. Hi, Vivian Stanchel, trumpet.
So this is the third single by the Bonzos. This is the Bonzos Go Pop, essentially,
yes,
in terms of what they're doing. They've done two records on Parlophone, which did absolutely nothing and were done in sort of 1920s, 30s jazz style.
Yes.
Not that they abandoned that, of course. That sort of is seeded through the stuff that's coming up. But then they change manager. They get a new manager producer and they start doing anything, essentially, I think was their creed at this point.
Yeah.
And it was released, they moved to Liberty Records, which is an American record label, LBF 15040, collecting fans. And and this record did absolutely nothing as well.
Yeah.
So this, you know, the Bonzo story is not one of great chart successes, save for that one particular record that we'll mention at some point.
Yeah.
But this is a wonderful single, though, isn't it? I mean, in terms of how it represents the band and what sort of... This is a great record for just giving you an instant hit of what the Bonzos is all about.
Yes, particularly the journey from the A side to the B side. So the difference, the stark difference. and it's got, you know, the Equestrian Statue is actually quite a beautiful Neil song. It's, you know, it sounds lovely and it's properly played. And, you know, but it's... And it's sort of poking fun at a British institution, which is, you know, Neil's MO.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing. And, you know, it does have echoes of their big hit because you go on a proper ride from, hearing side A to listening to side B and the difference between them, because you've got a Neil track and you've got a Viv track. Yeah, Viv brings the nonsense as usual.
Yeah, it's definitely a case of Neil's bringing the sort of wistful pop wonder on one side, which he often did. I mean, Neil always makes me feel quite wistful, which is strange because he also makes me feel really, really happy. But he's always had a sort of slightly melancholic quality to it. But it's beautiful, beautiful melodies. But then, of course, you flip to Viv, who exists in a whole other mind space to, well, almost any other human that's ever lived, I think, with Viv, really.
Yeah.
And it was just remarkable that these people found each other and collaborated and tolerated each other and fell out with each other and drank with each other and filled rooms with smoke with each other and all that stuff that they did. Yeah, the Equestrian Statue is brilliant, which of course has a Liverpool connection, which I love because of the where it came from. So did Neil tell you anything about Equestrian Statue and how it came to be?
Do you know, he didn't, which I know is not a great answer. This is why this is why I was worried. I think what I will say, which is a useful thing, not in answer to your question. So this is their first single where they sort of went from doing the trad jazz stuff into sort of pop and rock and writing their own songs and actually making their own stuff. And they... Basically, what happened, they were doing their sort of weird trad jazz things in their, you know, proper outfits and all of that. And then they were asked to become the new vaudeville band.
Yeah.
Which was a sort of not a real band. And Bob Kerr, who had been in the Bonzos for a bit playing trumpet, he went off and joined them and kind of... I mean, they're, depending on who you talk to, whether he stole it or whether it was just a coincidence or, you know, it's hotly debated. But basically, the new vaudeville band ended up doing what the Bonzos were doing.
Winchester Cathedral.
The Bonzos kind of went, well, we have to write our own stuff. And because actually, they are actually all talented musicians who, you know how to produce music, particularly Neil and Viv, they kind of ran with that and it allowed them to be creative and it allowed them to really let rip when they were, you know, putting stuff together. And I mean, I was going to say let rip in the studio, but they weren't allowed to let rip in the studio because their manager... Jerry Bron had an idea that it shouldn't take you more than 3 hours to make a track.
Yes, which is, I mean, by modern standards, that's absolutely ludicrous. It's pretty ludicrous even then.
The Beatles were a thing then. I mean, I don't think that that's true. Didn't they spend months on?
Well, by this point, yeah, I suppose 1967, they just vanish into the studio for months at a time to work on stuff.
Yeah.
4 years, you know, 3 years earlier, yeah, they were in and out in hours, but they were, you know, they were playing well-rehearsed material with no overdubs.
Yes.
So, but by 1967, to limit someone say, oh, 3 hours, that's it. It feels more like that's someone watching their wallet rather than the end results, I think.
I think so, yeah. And, you know, they would occasionally, there is an incredible story about them being given some studio time, but they didn't have anything to record. And so Viv just used the studio time to make some hutches for his rabbits. And was, you know, obviously caught and asked what he was doing. And it's like, I'm making hutches. So it was just that. So they, you know, I think once they, the more restrictions that were put on them, these are the rules, you have to do it in this time, you have to do it, they, the more they would subvert it and the more they would kind of go out of their way to not do it. But I think that's sort of slightly after this point. I think with Equestrian Statue and Intro and the Outro, Intro and the Outro obviously took a little longer to record because of the sheer number of tracks that are on it. And, you know, they were recording on 4-track at the time. So that's why people fade in and out and you've got this bass line, and they would make 4 tracks and they would bounce it down and play that through as 1 track, and then they would make 3 new tracks, and that's basically how they put the whole thing together.
Yeah. It's remarkable, actually, that it's listenable at all, because every time you bounce down, you have another generation of noise on top of everything
exactly.
else that you've done.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's listenable is a testament to its preservation over the years.
Yes,
I think
so.
Yeah. So, I mean, Equestrian Statue, you're like, say, the Liverpool connection is, so as far as I understand it, Neil was inspired by, you know, the band rocking up in Liverpool, and he sees the Equestrian Statues outside St. George's Hall in the city centre here, which every time I see them, not that I go to town very much at the moment, or for the past year at least anyway, I think of the Equestrian Statue and Neil. It's lovely. So if you emerge from Lime Street Station, they're one of the first things you'll see. So I like that. That's a nice little connection there. And obviously it's a bit of a Penny Lane ripoff as well. Well, not a ripoff, it's in the style of that Baroque pop type of feel. I mean, he does sort of, there's a few quotes with him dropping little cheeky hints about Penny Lane being there as well. And they've got the funny little high-pitched trumpet at the end too.
Feel so gay. Feel so gay. Feel so gay.
Yes, yeah. I mean, and you know, Neil did enjoy a harpsichord. So, you know, obviously this was long before he was known for parodying the Beatles. Let's say parodying rather than ripping off.
Yes.
But, you know, I think they were always, like when they were, because they had started writing their own stuff, they were very aware of what was happening in the world of rock and pop. And they looked for ways to puncture it, looked for ways to parody it, look for ways to subvert it. And, you know, like when they, around this time, they were also on Do Not Adjust Your Sex. That was 67, 68. They were working with Eric Idle and Michael Palin and Terry Jones on that. And, you know, those three kind of say that the Bonzos taught them how to be anarchic and taught them how to be chaotic within a framework. You can put that on TV. You can actually perform that way. You can have that level of chaos and fun. And I think this single, I think all of their singles, to be honest, but this single is a good example of that you can be musically brilliant and bang on and listable and well-produced and well-oiled machine when you're performing and all of that. But you can also have the very silly, very ridiculous at the same time. There is no reason why you can't do both.
Yeah.
And that's a much better way to be.
Well, talking about the very silly and very ridiculous then, we'll talk a bit about the intro and the outro, which is, like I say, it was one of the first ones I heard when I got that, I borrowed that Bonzos compilation, because I think it's usually stuck at the front end of those things, and just being blown away with the silliness of it. It's so simple. It's wonderfully simple, but, and even if you don't get all the references in it, it's just so funny. The comic timing of Hitler is just like,
yes.
What? Looking very relaxed on vibes.
Yeah, and Princess Anne on sousaphone. I mean, even the choice of instruments is pretty much perfect.
Billy Butlin, spoons. And looking very relaxed, Adolf Hitler on vibes. Nice. Princess Anne on sousaphone. Introducing Liberace clarinet with Garner Ted Armstrong on vocals.
Yeah, and also, you know, there is in the ridiculous list of people who are playing on it, they say that Eric Clapton is on ukulele. Eric Clapton was on ukulele.
Yes.
That's the only true one.
Over there, Eric Clapton, ukulele. Hi, Eric. On my left, Sir Kenneth Park, bass sax. Great honour, sir.
It's just so funny. It is so funny. And it stands up no matter how many times you listen to it. I think there's something always to laugh at. I think Viv's little asides of nice and, you know, little references to people's playing, the jazz kind of enjoyment of it all. I just think it's great. It's just so funny.
It is brilliant. Like the sound effects with Roy Rogers on trigger and stuff like that. And I like the fact as well, it sort of seeds little future things like the Rawlinsons, which are going to play a much bigger part in Viv's story as the years go by. But the fact that Clapton's on it speaks as well to how quickly the Bonzos were adopted by all those super cool blues club bands of the
period. They were gigging with them. The Bonzos were the highest paid band without a record in the charts on the touring circuit at that time. So they didn't need to release a single. So this is why they didn't really care about having a hit. They didn't really care about... They were a well-paid working band, and they were touring with people like Clapton and Joe Cocker and doing these huge gigs. And, you know, these very serious musicians would kind of be quite jealous that they could go on stage and play, because... I don't mean play music. I mean play like children, because... You know, Eric Clapton was a serious musician and he had to kind of go out there and be God or whatever it was he said he was. So they brought something that no one else did. So having them on a bill with a load of other serious, other successful musicians, it's a really interesting thing that you could just turn up and see Joe Cocker and supported by the Bonzos.
Yeah,
they didn't want to follow them a lot of the time.
I'm not surprised. Not least because it would have taken him ages to sweep the stage clean of all the bits and pieces.
Well, and explosions and things like that, blowing up people's drum kits and things. I think it's quite understandable. They were closing gigs and they were doing really well at that time. And it's sort of, that's why they didn't really care about the singles that they released. They weren't interested in chart success because they were making a living and they were having fun while they were doing it. And they were seeing all these other people, you know, Viv was very good friends with Paul McCartney and Neil was good friends with George Harrison. And, you know, all of it, they saw their friends being famous pop stars or rock stars and not really getting to have that much fun.
Yeah.
Whereas they were literally going on stage and blowing everyone away, quite literally. And, you know, I don't think anything could have persuaded them to stop doing that. It's like, well, no, we're making money. We're not making as much money, but why would we give up the fun? Why would we be serious? Why? I don't want that. None of them wanted that. So, yeah, I think that's why they never really cared about the chart success. And if anything, they were kind of annoyed when they did eventually get it.
Yeah. It's interesting, I suppose, as well, from what the research I've been looking at is they go on to Liberty. Liberty actually didn't put out that many copies of their first few, like, couple of albums, you know.
No.
They didn't actually release enough of any of the product for it to chart, even if everyone had bought every single copy of it at the time. So I don't know quite why that is, but I don't know, caution on the part of an American record label doing it for, I don't know. Anyway, that's just speculation. But, of course, the weird thing is Equestrian Statue does nothing, but the next single that comes out is I'm the Urban Spaceman, backed with Canyons of Your Mind, two absolutely perfect songs, in my opinion.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, perfectly Neil and perfectly Viv. And, you know, I feel like Equestrian Statue and Intro the Outro is like it's the introduction. It's the start. This is what the Bonzos can do. We're leaving behind the trad jazz stuff, which, you know, is still fun to play and it's still fun to kind of have at gigs. But actually, we can make this stuff happen. We can take you on this sort of a journey. It's far more interesting when they started making their own stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, the as they would, well, as Neil would talk about doing the medley of hit.
It got to
number five, I think, in the charts, didn't it?
Yeah, number five.
Evan Spaceman.
Yeah.
I wake up every morning with a smile upon my face.
Most of the conversations I've had with Neil about Bonzo stuff is in the course of making programs. So it's sort of a weird thing in that he's not really told me things, but he was talking to Stephen Fry. This is how this starts. It's just clang. So Neil and I made an archive on 4 for Radio 4 in 2016, and it was called Anarchy Must Be Organized, and it was a history of the Bonzos. And in that we had Adrian Edmondson and Stephen Fry and Kevin Eldon and Diane Morgan and Terry Gilliam, and Rod Slater was in it as well. Well, we spoke to all of the Bonzos, but Rod Slater's in it the most because Neil and Rod, we recorded for nearly 3 hours.
Wow.
Because they were having such a lovely time, and I just went, do you know what, just chat, just go and just keep talking, it's fine. So they, and you know, they just kind of reminisced about everything, and it was incredible. But Stephen Fry says that he heard Urban Spaceman and kind of it was quite jolly, and yeah, this is nice. This is a bit different to your standard pop songs, and it's quite, you know, it's got nice turns of phrase in it and all of that. And then he says he turned it over and listened and heard Canyons in the Mine, and he just went, "Oh, hello, this is me now. This is, I'm home. This is where I belong. This is the weirdness I'm looking for. This is the otherness I feel."
This is the B side of our platter, sports fans. And I'm singing just for you, covered in sequins.
In the canyons of your mind.
And I love that. I love that that's what the Bonzos offered. I love that they offered that mad, chaotic musical genius. I love that it's a mix of comedy and beautiful words and beautiful music. I love that. That's why I love them.
Yeah. No, that's yeah, flipping over to Canyons of Your Mind is a revelation.
It's a hell of a ride.
Any song that contains the phrase, the sweet essence of giraffe, which you're just not expecting to come out of the musical setting of the song, and suddenly you hit that and it's like, this is, then the frying pan backing vocals and all that's...
Yeah.
It was brilliant. It's funny, they meant so much to me at university. I studied music at music and popular music at university. So I went in 1997, which is about when I suddenly hit with the Bonzos. I started finding out as much as I could.
Yeah.
And having a task to do for that, where I had to annotate an entire piece of music, and I just did Urban Spaceman.
Nice.
And just the joy of being able to sit in my lecturer's office discussing the fact, you know, so, yeah, there's two drum kits on this. Oh, yes. Just being able to celebrate that glorious, sweet stupidity of it all.
Yes.
It was nice. While everyone else was doing cool things, I was analysing.
No,
the Bonzos.
The thing is, I kind of feel like enthusiasm gets you a long way. I think that, you know, if you find something that sort of, I mean, it sounds a bit wanky, but if you find something that speaks to you like that, you know, and I think that coming together of taking the piss out of music, I suppose, is the thing I like about them. I like that they're not taking themselves seriously. They were taking themselves seriously, but they were deliberately not doing what pop music does. And they were going, well, this is what pop music does, so we're going to take it and we're going to shake it up and we're going to literally shake it, make a mess of it, and put this out and do it that way. And I find that way more interesting. Anything that can make me laugh has got my attention.
I think that's a good summary of their uniqueness, really.
One of the things I love about Canyons of Your Mind is Neil won the worst guitar solo in, I can't remember the name of the magazine, but it was some sort of serious guitar music magazine. He was awarded like worst guitar solo for it, and it basically, they were trying to make the worst guitar solo. So his guitar solo in Canyons is unbelievably bad. And apparently when they were first recording it, he did this awful, awful guitar solo, and they all fell about laughing, and no one had recorded it.
Oh.
So the first attempt is lost. It doesn't exist anywhere. But so then they did record it, and he had another go. But Neil maintained that the second one wasn't quite as funny as the first, which I find hard to believe, because it is perfectly off key and perfectly out of time.
Yeah, it's quite a skill to be able to do that, to play that sort of badly.
Yeah.
You know, rather than just a bit fumbly, to actually make it so in the gaps between where it needs to be.
It's the Les Dawson thing, isn't it? It's the Les Dawson piano playing, yes, which is perfectly off key. And it's that thing, you've got to be good at it to be able to do it that badly. Because anyone could play it badly, but actually to do it perfectly badly, you need to know what you're doing. And... interestingly, I didn't mean to bring this up, but the first time I met Neil, I was making a program about Les Dawson, and I wanted somebody who knew how to do bad music well, or good music badly, or whatever you want to call it. I wanted a musical genius to talk about how good musically Les Dawson was. And I asked Neil, because why wouldn't you use your career to meet people that you love? So I asked him, and he said yes. And so he is in the first program I ever made, which is about Les Dawson, talking about that. And he plays piano off key for me and all of this stuff. And that was how I met him. And then, because we sort of had a very nice day, you know, dicking about on a piano in Broadcasting House, we stayed in touch. And he asked if I would... because it was a 3-hour celebration of Les Dawson, he asked if I'd thought of doing one about Viv Stanshall. And I kind of went, well, I haven't, but I am now.
Yes.
And so Neil and I made that together. So in 2014, we made a 3-hour program about Viv and his career. And Neil presented that. And so, you know, we started with the Bonzos and... then sort of went off into Viv's solo career and all through the Rawlinsons and all of that. But Neil hosted that for Radio 4 Extra. So that was the first time we kind of properly worked together. And that was also when we had Rod in. So that was when we recorded for nearly 3 hours, because they just... I suppose the two of them didn't really... I mean, why would you? You don't really sit down with an ex-bandmate and talk about the good old days. Like, that opportunity doesn't come up very often. And I think they really enjoyed actually being able to laugh at their younger selves and kind of remember all the stupid stuff they got up to. Yeah, so that's when Rod Slater came in for that program to talk about Viv, because obviously Rod worked with Viv right up until Viv's death.
Yes.
So, you know, he was involved in a lot of Viv's solo work and that kind of thing. Yeah, of all of the Bonzos, I think Rod was kind of... I mean, Rod is... utterly delightful. Rod Slater is just such a lovely, lovely man. And he got on with everybody and he didn't really enter into the falling outs and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, he sort of stayed in touch with everybody and was friends with everybody and continued working with everybody. And I think, yeah, that's quite a nice thing that happened there.
Yeah, that's lovely. Yeah, I think what you're getting at here really is this fantastic way of... specifically Neil, when you meet Neil or you start to understand who Neil is through the music and the material, I was like, he seems like someone I'd like to know.
Yeah.
And on my few occasions where I have had the opportunity to say a brief hello after a gig or whatever, he's always been an absolute charmer. And he did once or twice make a little bit of extra time to chat to me once when I used to teach music, and I was talking to him about the British songwriting experience or the British music experience, where he'd done some sessions. And he hung around after a gig so he could talk to me and tell me about what he'd done there. And that was just like, I just felt so treated.
Yeah.
He didn't need to do that. He just played a whole show, you know.
Yeah, but he always did that. He always, after every gig, he would stay until everybody who wanted to talk to him had talked to him. And he was always really keen to do that, very generous with his time. Like, he was, I mean, he was such a lovely man, and he was so kind to me, so ridiculously kind to me. So yeah, so the program about that we made together about Viv was the second program I'd ever made, so I still didn't really know what I was doing. And it was very early in my career. Yeah, it felt like such a huge honor to be working with somebody who just knew how things should sound and how it should be, and didn't have oddly, for somebody who had, I mean, he wouldn't consider himself in showbiz, but he had worked in show business for such a long time, and he wasn't bitter or angry or beaten down by it. He was just, he approached everything with a sense of fun. That's all he wanted to do. That was his motivation. He wanted to do fun things with nice people. That was how he decided what he wanted to do. And I think he felt, particularly like once they started touring as the Ruttles again, and I think he realized that he was in a room full of people who were nice. They were good people. The people that were there were good, nice, fun people. And so he was quite happy to talk to them, to talk to everybody in the crowd. And, you know, I'd always feel a bit, you know, I went to see the Ruttles a lot, and yeah, I'd sort of hang around after the gigs and I'd queue because I never would feel like, it's, I don't know, I sort of, even now, I kind of, we worked together a lot, and my husband and I went to stay with him and Yvonne in France. Like, we were friends, but yeah, it still feels like an incredibly ridiculous thing to even begin to say. So I don't feel comfortable saying that, but, you know, I don't know what else you'd say. But he was, he was just so, so kind and generous and lovely, and I... Yeah, it just every time I got to spend any time with him felt like an honour. And the fact that I got to work with him and kind of see his creative mind going at full pelt and the energy and the enthusiasm he would bring to everything we did, and the way he would sort of not want to do it in the standard, you know, like, I'm just going to write a script and I'm going to read the script and I'll link between stuff. It was like, there was always a way of, how can we subvert this? How can we play with radio? How can we play with audio? How can we mess about, make it sound a bit different? And it was just so exciting to watch that happen and then be the facilitator of it and actually go, oh yeah, I'll go away and edit this, and I know exactly what you mean, and I'm going to go and make that happen. And then I'd send him stuff and he would like it. And then, you know, he would send me things that nobody had heard and ask me for my opinion because he thought I was good at my job. And all of this just feels so insane to me because I'd loved him and his work all my life, literally all of my life. And then to actually meet him and for him to be so still kind of full of wonder and enthusiasm for just creating good stuff, good, funny, entertaining stuff. It was brilliant. It was so brilliant to be able to be a tiny, tiny part of that.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Have you got a favourite sort of any of his solo stuff that you particularly like? You know, the music or any of the projects?
I mean,
because there's quite a lot actually when you look at it.
There's a huge amount. I don't know that I can answer that because lots of things have just popped into my head. I think possibly the single album of his I've listened to the most, I suppose, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's a favorite. But I think just because there was a point where that was the only one I had, would be Recycled Vinyl Blues.
Yeah.
Which sort of had bits of Innes Book of Records on it, and it was sort of a collected compilation of his stuff. That's probably the album I've listened to the most.
I think probably the same for me, because I think it was for a while just about the only thing available.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
And I think it had, yeah, it had most of the sort of How Sweet to Be an Idiot era record on it.
Yeah.
Didn't it? And then all the, but it's such, there's some really good rockers on there, some proper boogie rock stuff.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Yeah. And, oh, you know, obviously Innes Book of Records isn't available. And so to have like little glimpses of it, and, you know, on that album, there's Michael Palin's on it, and it's kind of like, well, that's, you know, he's not playing the thing he did in, because he was PC Palin in Innes Book of Records, but he's, I don't know, just to hear him crop up delights me.
Excuse me, I'd like to make a hit record.
Certainly, sir. Did you bring any old records with you?
Well, no, why?
Well, you see, we can't possibly make any new records unless we've got some old ones to melt down.
Good heavens, bad as that, is it?
Afraid so, sir. No notice. That was just a bit of an old record that was used to make this one.
Good grief.
I don't know. Like, I don't know that I could pick one thing. Neil's work has brought me so much joy. For that reason, I can't really pick a favourite, because all of it kind of fills me with this... It is just pure joy. It is just happy, lovely, and it's, you know, it's beautiful music. The words are incredible, and the songs he writes mean something. They're always about something. They make a point, but they make it in the most beautiful, interesting way. He didn't look at the world in the same way as anybody else did.
Yeah.
And so he would come at subjects like, you know, he would kind of poke fun at mainstream things, but he would see things in it or notice sort of details about it that I don't think other people do. And he would get the laugh from that.
Yes, yeah. Or he'd tug on the heartstrings. That's, I find quite a lot of his stuff quite wistful and slightly melancholic. It's sort of, you know, he could do something like a song called Not Getting Any Younger.
Yeah.
Which is just this beautiful bit of lounge jazz, but it's so relatable even when you're young to this subject of change and growing old and stuff. Something that he obviously pondered on from time to time and crops up a few times, that sort of subject. And stuff like that just makes me absolutely melt.
Yeah.
And I suppose now is even more poignant.
Yeah.
Prices always going up, buildings coming down. Lots of decent, crazy people living my home.
Just a marvellous man, really. One of the other first times I met him was at the Bonzers reunion show, and I will always, always remember getting the programme signed and him just saying, "What's your name?" And saying, "It's Paul." I must apologise for the electric leg not working tonight. it's like, have you said that to everyone? Have you just, or do I just look like someone who was upset about an electric leg not working? It's just one of the nicest things anyone's ever said to me. It's just so strange. Oh, never forget. I'll just take us back to the equestrian statue briefly.
I feel like I've not said very much about it, which I was worried about doing, but that's fine.
I wouldn't worry about it, but... this is supposed to be very celebratory, and it is, and it's wonderful. But I did find a couple of contemporary reviews. I haven't got access to stacks of like Enemies or Melody Makers or anything. So I did a little bit. So of course I've got the review from the Daily Mail of all places.
Great. Yeah, I'm sure they were well into it.
Well, it's 18th of November 1967. There was a review written by Virginia Ironside.
What a name.
Yes, it's a very strident sort of name, isn't it?
I feel like she could be on saxophone or something.
Yeah, quite possibly. Yeah, good name, very solid name. And it's only short. It says, though I have nothing against this group, the whole pop comedy bit, brackets, Baron Knights, New Vaudeville Band, etc., is not my scene at all. In fact, she says at all twice like that, making a point. However, this is a good example of its kind, and the actual melody is not at all bad.
Ah.
So that's the Daily Mail being relatively nice.
Yeah, yeah. How odd.
Whereas Rave magazine, which is a proper countercultural, sort of teen countercultural magazine, a bit more sort of, prettied up for the masses a little bit. I don't believe that Rave actually wrote this review, because as I read it out, you'll understand. There's a picture of Viv and the little caption saying Vivian send up record. Oh, do you know what? I've just noticed actually the top of this, being a divvy that I am, Vivian Stanchel of the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band reviews equestrian statue.
Right.
That's what the headline is. I missed that bit at the top. So that's why it's a weird review.
You were right about them not Rave not writing it.
Yeah, no, they just get the band to do it themselves. He says, this is a saga of a man on a horse. It's a send-up record with a mock Beatles ending as played by the Northern Dance Orchestra. And there's a Tarzan call in it too. Well, there isn't an equestrian statue, so I don't know what Viv was thinking of. He must have been thinking of the flip side or something. Or maybe it's there in the background somewhere.
Yeah, it's probably one of the layers, isn't it? They did like their layers.
It says, it's off our new LP, Gorilla. Neil Innes, who wrote the song, sings it with a rather touching nursery rhyme quality. So there's Viv reviewing his own band.
His own band, yeah.
For the turned on teen kids who are buying rave magazine.
Yeah. I'm now trying to think about, I'm trying to play it in my head as to whether there's a Tarzan call.
No, I don't think there is. I don't think there is on that. There's Tarzan calls elsewhere in Bonzo's
well,
material.
Well, yes, you know. Quite.
He might have had a few too many brown ales before he wrote that review.
I mean, almost certainly, yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting time for it to come out. I mean, I can't get the exact date that the single came out, but it was a late October, early November 67, you know, and yet the top 10 for that period is like, that they're going up against is people like Baby Now That I've Found You by the Foundations, Massachusetts by the Bee Gees, Autumn Almanac by the Kinks, the wonderful Zabadak by Dave D. Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch. Even.
Like, that needs to be harder to say.
Yeah, absolutely. The Last Waltz by Engelbert Humperdinck and Love Is All Around by the Troggs, that sort of thing.
Yes.
You know, the Who are there with I Can See for Miles. The thing is, it's as good as many of those and better than several.
Well, I think the important thing is, like, and actually it's kind of the point that the Mail were making in a slightly snarky way, that they are a fusion of comedy and music. They're not comedians doing music. They're not musicians trying to be funny. They are equal proportions comedy and music. They are funny people doing music. So some of the music is brilliant and, you know, sort of stands up on its own as a rock or pop song. But then they can't resist a laugh. They can't resist a pun. They can't resist a punchline. They can't resist something utterly ridiculous. They just can't resist it. And why would you? If it's there, why resist? Why stop yourself having that fun? So they're not musical comedy. They're not comedy music. They're just what they are. They're just the Bonzos. They're just funny. They're just entertaining. It's pure, silly entertainment set to music.
Yeah. But and the thing is, it's not light entertainment. It's quite... Nope. It's weird entertainment. And that's what I think, what, you know, try to get to their uniqueness and why perhaps in some case, in a way, a lot of people don't know of the Bonzos, who might know every single out of the 60s, you know, the people who like Cream and like the Who and know all about all of that, you know, might not consider the Bonzos in those terms at all. But
they appeared on bills with them. They were part of that scene. And they were part of that scene and deliberately subverting it while they were in it.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think even like Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention were Bonzo's fans.
Yeah.
And they were doing something similar, but totally from the musical end of it.
Yeah.
Really. Much as lots of that stuff is very funny as well and is doing what the Bonzos did, which is in the 60s certainly subverting the pop pomposity.
Yes.
I'll try and say that without blowing my microphone up. That Neil emerged from it, as you say, quite so normal.
Yeah, unscathed.
For someone who'd done so much that was not normal.
But
we are normal and we want our freedom.
Yes. I think his role in the band was kind of keeping it actually a functioning band. I think he, you know, there was a lot of chaos. Everybody brought their own brand of chaos. And I think Neil's brand of chaos is always finding the silly, finding the fun, finding the subversion. I think that was his approach. But you can do that and, you know, not be blowing stuff up. And I think, you know, I think if we see them as sort of a Lennon and McCartney partnership, you've got Neil being, I mean, he said he was the brakes, that Viv was the engine and Neil was the brakes. And I don't think that's true. But I think maybe Neil was the steering wheel. he was like, no, let's go over here. Let's stay on this road. Let's keep going straight along here. Let's turn off down this road. Let's go down there and see what adventure that is. I don't think he didn't stop the fun. but he was a sort of facilitator of it and kind of going, let's make sure we can keep doing this. Let's, you know, let's continue being as creative as we can possibly be and still get gigs and still be able to share this with people. I think Neil is a big part of the reason why they were on bills with other, you know, hugely successful 60s bands. And, you know, they met everybody you can possibly think of from the 60s, like the 60s music scene. And, you know, you'd kind of be, I'd find myself kind of talking to Neil and he would suddenly sort of tell a story about meeting Jimi Hendrix or...
Yes.
And it's just kind of like, well, I can't believe I'm talking to somebody who did that. Like, that's insane. But they were part of that scene. But from, as I say, from inside it, they were poking fun at it. The weirdness that they brought to it was them seeing psychedelia for what it was. Rather than actually losing their minds, they were going, no, we can do that. We can just do it. We don't have to be off our faces. Yeah. We can just do it. And
absolutely.
It's just finding... the kind of the root of stuff and the core of stuff of things that were as actually happening around them, the sort of attention to detail involved in that is quite something, I think.
And the art school thing really mattered to them as well, certainly as to Neil, didn't it? Whereas many bands met in art school.
Yes.
You know, but that sort of didn't then factor into their careers particularly. It really did. Dadaism and surrealism really mattered to Neil, didn't it?
Yes, yeah, it really did. And I mean, I think it kind of mattered to all of them. And like Viv sort of trained with Lindsay Kemp, so he sort of learned how to move and that kind of thing. And I think Neil's interest in Dadaism was not only the actual art that came out of it, but actually the things that caused it and the fact that it was the sort of unjust, you know, circumstances of the First World War and the fact that this nonsense flourished from that. This horrible time brought about something that was just in search of pure joy. It wasn't about anything else. And it was using fun to make a point about the bad things. And I kind of feel like that's what the Bonzos were trying to do. I think that's what Neil was always trying to do. I think it's what Python were trying to do. I think, you know, all of their sort of authoritative characters were always the ridiculous, the pompous, the, you know, and that was society at that point. And I think maybe they felt like by poking fun at it, they'd fixed it. And I think we can see from the situation we're in now, that's not the case. But
sadly,
but I think it's a really important thing to do, to not take authority that seriously and not, you know, to actually see things for what they are. We're all just people. And I think they were very good at identifying, we're all just people and you're that type of person and you're in that position of power and you're this type of person. And I think they were very good at sort of seeing, they were just very good at seeing through things, I think. And they put that into all of their different songs. Neil in a wistful pop way, Viv in a chaotic, you know, bright pink drainpipe sort of way.
Yes. Well, I've got the stack of the albums next to me here. It's just such a wonderful collection of stuff. And of course, all the Bonzos contribute an amazing amount to the chaos and madness on these things.
Yeah.
You know, you need all of those guys together to create it, but you needed sort of Neil and Viv to helm it so that you end up with an album that can have Quiet Talks and Summer Walks as one track, you know, an absolutely beautiful love song from Neil.
Such a sad, lovely, beautiful song. Yeah, yeah.
I was born in the spring of this year, warmed by the sun and the wind that brought me here.
But the next song is Tent.
Yeah.
I'm gonna get you in my tent. The tango in my tent.
I mean, they, you know, they were thoroughly interesting. They weren't boring at any point.
True.
You know, every journey between tracks was an exciting adventure. And I think that there's a lot to be said for that. I think it, you know, that you couldn't really pin them down. You couldn't say, oh, that's what they did. it was all about the pursuit of fun and poking fun.
Yeah, it is. And it's a shame that their other records didn't do better, or the singles particularly. You know, because they put Mr. Apollo out with Ready Mades on the flip side. That doesn't do anything. I Want to Be With You with We Were Wrong, which is a brilliant combination again, that, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I love both of those songs.
Yeah. One is an absolutely, again, a beautiful Neil love song. And the other side is a love song, but gone wrong.
Yeah.
Through the Viv mirror.
Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't do anything. You Done My Brain In, backed with Mr. Slater's Parrot, doesn't do out. Mm. Oh, I got very northern then, sorry. Yeah, it's a bit of a shame they didn't quite have the success I think they could have had at the time. But they, you know, they were happy with it in the end.
Yeah, they didn't want it. And as I say, you know, the there were some parts of the band who were kind of annoyed that they'd had a chart hit and they were expected to, you know, do the chart thing and do the, you know, the rounds of pop programs and stuff like that. And it's, I think Neil didn't really care for the sort of the fluff of showbiz. I don't think he was sort of that enamored by it. So he just sort of got on with it. And, you know, sometimes he had to be on telly. Sometimes he had to do interviews. Fine. You know, he'd go do gigs. He'd enjoy doing gigs. He'd talk to fans. There would be fans there. That was always a nice thing. That was a nice byproduct. People who actually cared and actually liked what he was doing. That's always a nice thing. Whereas I think some of the band actively didn't want that. And, you know, they did a disastrous tour of America, and it kind of all fell apart while they were on the road. I think it was quite a stressful thing. And, you know, some people wanted to go do telly spots and some people didn't. And it just, there were too many of them and they were all pulling in different directions. And even now, they don't agree on what they should or shouldn't have done. And so it just sort of stopped.
Yeah. But what a legacy. I mean, you know, how many people they've influenced, and just like the people you met doing those programs.
Yeah.
And they're the tip of a huge iceberg of people who love the Bonzos.
Yeah. And you know, the people who were involved in the Bonzos reunion tour, that sort of generation of comedy. So that's sort of the one that kind of came out in the 80s, early 90s. I think, you know, everybody knows Python. Anyone involved in comedy knows Python. But I think quite a lot of the people, which is, you know, I'm not the same age as Adrian Edmondson by any stretch, but I think they seem to do the same thing I did, in that they got into Python and then they found the Bonzos, and then it was like, oh wait, you can do this, you can actually have anarchy. And I think that influenced so much. And, you know, there's a Neil and Viv in the Young Ones. It's undeniable, the influence.
That's true, yes. Yeah, I hadn't put that two and two together, actually, but absolutely, that's amazing.
Yeah, so it's, you know, they were huge fans, and then Adrian got to work with Neil, and I think he felt about it in the same way I did, whereas, you know, and he's Adrian Edmondson, so he's got all of that to back it up. But, you know, I think everybody I spoke to in the making of those programmes was just so delighted to get to spend some time with Neil, and was sort of, everybody kind of said thank you to him for the legacy of just kind of allowing them not to be normal, you know, not to fit. It's okay to not fit in. You can actually be on the fringe or be the odd kid or the, you know, whatever. I think it sort of allowed a lot of the sort of the oddness that you need to get into comedy. I think a lot of that was facilitated by things like the Bonzos and Python, and that sort of, that pursuit of fun and that oddness, I think it made it more acceptable to people. And everybody was thanking Neil for that.
And that seems massively appropriate, because there's a lot to thank him for.
Yeah.
And I think that's just about a perfect place to end as well. And then it means I can say thank you to you, Laura, for bringing the Bonzos and your Tales of Neil onto the show. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm very, very happy to talk about Neil Innes. He was such an important figure in my life, both as a fan and as a work colleague and friend. He was the best.
Hooray.